Welcome back to the podcast. We've had a short break, and I'd like to return and ask Tim to both talk about his own personal experience of care and of his wife Anna, and also the way that that care helped him to think about the kind of decisions that have to be made and the kind of systems we have to have in order to look after ill and dying people. So, Tim, we started to talk about systems that were containing and helped the clinicians to make good decisions and to care carefully, and the need for the clinical staff, whether it's nurses, care assistants, doctors or whatever, to work in an environment which is supportive and understanding of the work that they do and the pressure that they are under. So can we, if you like, start with the personal and then move on to what we can learn from that?
Yes, the personal, after all these years of research, it was then difficult to find that I was having to think about all of this much closer to home, that my wife Anna was diagnosed with early onset dementia when she was 54. She'd been a social worker and a nurse herself, and had come through a lot of the systems that that we all need, and had herself written about the experience of being a nurse when she was young and first working with dying patients. When she herself became ill, she was quite articulate about this and made a distinction when she found she was now in the middle of some maelstrom of all kinds of people coming and trying to help, that she made a distinction between those that she saw as busybodies and getting in the way, to those that she saw as mediators, and she used that word, because they were able to mediate the experience that she was having as someone becoming more dependent and facing a very uncertain future, and the realities of what needed to be sorted and put in place for her. She was also able to articulate what many people, according to the research, would say, is that she wanted to die at home. And that was a very clear message, which then we had to see, well, was that going to be realistic or not? I'm not going to go into the whole story of this, except to say that she did die at home. Just to take one moment in that, when she was really very, very ill, and was not sure how much longer she did have to live, the psychiatrist who was managing her care visited her at home and saw her and saw how frail and vulnerable she was looking. And this doctor reached for her phone immediately to call the services to take Anna into hospital. And then she stopped and put the phone back and accepted that this was not a time for the heroic intervention, but to stay with the stoical response of how do we continue to provide the care. That moment, the doctor, she talked to me afterwards about this. She said she had to go against all of her training to do that. And so it makes me think about the kind of leadership that we might expect, we might look for. And sometimes that leadership is to say, we will not intervene as much as the sea. That's enough. We'll take over. We'll do what we can. It was accepting that actually at this time,
heroics weren't the right thing.
That's the way it was. And there she was, and I was no longer able to speak, but would have approved mm-hmm. that here was someone who was actually taking the mediator role mm. and not taking over.
Yes.
And moving away from actually what she had articulated as being her needs.
Yes.
And what she wanted to happen.
Had this psychiatrist been constant contact with Anna, or she must have known her well in order to make that decision?
She knew her bit. She knew her no better than any. She was the consultant psychiatrist who was responsible for her care.
And what do you think enabled that consultant to rely on her humanity, if you like, rather than her training? If it was a conflict between the two, a kind of ethical conflict?
I think that the issues here really have to do with being clear what it is that we're trying to do. In military dialogue, there's this awful phrase about mission creep. Well, I think you get mission creep in the way that we're trying to look after people. So we start, we provide this care, that, and then we add a bit more in, and we add a bit more in. And all the time, that may be working, but also we're actually, at the same time, maybe making more of the dependency, so that in the end, these patients, there's nowhere else they can be but in hospital.
So we diminish their self-sufficiency, really.
We connect them up with machines.
But there's a real dilemma for doctors, isn't there, around using their training and their technology to do everything they can. And perhaps if I was in a doctor's shoes, I would be worrying about not doing things rather than about doing things. And would I be supported if there was a complaint or... Because this links into how did that doctor have the confidence that that decision would be upheld and she could be defended if there was a complaint.
I'm sure she had to work with those kinds of concerns. Mm. And I respect that. I just want to add something, though, to this. I have written about this in the book that you mentioned, Managing Vulnerability. I did this because it's almost impossible to get good research into these kinds of issues. The access of the researcher is not really to be able to explore the ethical dilemmas in quite the way that we're now able to be thinking as we're talking now. When we shared a platform, that doctor and I, we later at a medical conference on end-of-life care, there was clearly a reluctance in quite a lot of the professional audience to listen to what we were saying and to listen to the story. And I suspect that actually it was provocative, because it would be making us question all the decisions that we are making all the time. Mm. And we never know if we're going to get it right. Mm. So I'm not saying this is easy.
No. But there's a counter movement. If you take the movement towards following the patient's life needs and wider needs rather than just medical needs, that movement, but there's also a movement towards the fragmentation of specialisms, which puts a doctor in charge of one particular aspect of a patient's care, and the fragmentation of, say, the medical from the care, from the hospital to social care. So there's a huge fragmentation taking place in the medical field, not just from technology and increased specialisation, but also litigation and responsibility. And that's a movement away, if you like, from whole person care. So I think clinicians are caught in these different, between these different forces. And in a way, medical leadership is, should be to enable organisations and systems to surround and contain the, these dilemmas. And as you say, there's no right answer, really. It's a judgment in the end.
We all want to be doing what we're good at. And the specialisms are very important and make all the contributions that they that are there. The, as you're saying, we are stuck with the other side of this, which is how do we integrate the different specialisms that we have. In my own professional work, I'm still working with frontline staff who, for example, mental health nurses, who then have their feelings and their thoughts about the nurses working on the medical wards, and the nurses on the medical wards have their thoughts about
the doctors,
and we keep coming back to saying things like, "Well, this one's yours. This is one of yours." Right.
Yes.
This is a psych case.
Yes.
Right. You know, the difficulty that we have in working across boundaries, and what we do with all the initiatives is we create new teams, and every new team, it sets up another boundary that has to be managed. There's a lot said about our dependency on agency staff these days. There's a lot I could say about that, but there's one good thing about our dependency on agency staff. Some of them are very good, but in the nature of their contract, they work in different places around the system. And that is actually more conducive to knowing what others are doing and understanding the different perspectives. The leadership issue, whether it comes from medical leadership, which I think is also crucial, I was mentioning in our example, you know, the psychiatrist's leadership, but had to do with being able to hold that integrative stance and to trust in the other services that she's not herself responsible for, but to work with that.
Well, it's an interesting link, isn't it, to what you know, I'm struck by your definition of heroic and stoic leadership, that a hero, generally speaking, is alone, aren't they? They're the saviour. Whereas a stoic is a kind of almost a depressive who accepts that things are not perfect and people will fail and mistakes will be made, but we can overcome them, we can manage them. And so there's a... Would that be your part of your definition of stoic and heroic leadership? Maybe you'd say a bit more about those two methods of leading.
Yes, the heroic may be about the individual or certainly a small team. The rewards are intended to be evident. Generally speaking, the more a service might be defined as heroic, I think you'll find people are better paid than equivalent professionals doing work in more stoical systems.
The heroes, generally speaking, at the top of the tree, aren't they?
I think this is you know, if you look at the implicit hierarchies in health and social care, I suggest you'll find that dynamic working through.
We're talking a lot about, reasonably, I think, about dependency and old age and dementia and all of those things. And something struck me about what you were saying about dependency and rescuing it from failure, from the connotation of failure. And it seems to me that the, if you like, the more advanced our economies are, the less tolerance there is for any kind of dependency or vulnerability, and the more our machines are able to deliver very fast answers and very quick solutions, we can Google almost anything. There's a real tendency to have the illusion that we can be all-knowing and all-powerful. And yet doctors deal with the other side of humanity every day of their lives. You know, children with long-term conditions, babies that are born disabled, births that go wrong, all kinds of real-life trauma. It must be difficult for clinicians to stay open and to slow down and to manage that. Are we expecting far too much from them?
Oh, yes, I'm sure. We always expect whatever we think we can get. The work I did with Isabel Mingus Lyde, we were working a lot with doctors, and then I remember her saying doctors didn't want to be managers and that they had to accept that they were also managers as well as clinicians. And this was before we heard of general management and all the other changes that have taken place over the last 40 years. Now, I think we have to work in a very different context where the business model is very apparent and everyone is aware of the economic pressures that services are having to work around. So now the balance seems to me, if she was around now, she'd be saying, you know, they have to remember that they're doctors and they're not only managers. Yeah. So it is a difficult balance.
Because doctors and hospitals are embedded in wider society and a wider economic reality, and I suppose that the demand is unending, and that's one of the issues of managing healthcare. It's not like managing a business, in that you have to create a market for a business. In a way, what we have to do is reduce the market rather than increase it. But yet business models are used very widely in healthcare. And as I'm really debating with myself about whether that's adding to another pressure to the kind of heroic doctor who can cure everything and make us all better and not put any pressure on our families or ourselves. It's as if the doctor has to do everything, really.
Well, of course, as patients or as families, coming from that perspective, we're now learning, or we've learned very much, to take a consumerist view. So the professionals are having to cope with a much more, I think, more demanding, you know, sort of culture of, you know, the consumer, where we're told we can choose where we have the treatments and so on. A lot of these choices, of course, are not as great as they might seem. The model that we might look to are those who really have to face some of the historical challenges. So I think, for example, of the hospice movement that came up, as it were, outside of the mainstream, had to be outside because it was a cultural shift, and I think that we have to keep defending the historical position against the obvious things we appreciate from the heroical stance. I used to think that there was a distinction between health and social care, but social care is now required to take on quite heroic qualities. So some of the social care interventions are time-limited in a way that feels more consistent, you know, with a medical model of intervention. people work their way around this. I remember that there was someone who was working with someone in rehabilitation after a stroke. You know, they somehow managed to lose the notes because they were supposed to stop working with this. This person after
6 weeks, six weeks.
Well, you know, and they took their authority more from the task. That here was someone who actually needed a much more longer view of their care. It's difficult, sort of, to go public on a sort of challenge. Oh, perhaps you should be deviant against some of the protocols, but there are tensions.
Yes.
If you take the authority from the task, this is what is needed here.
Yes.
Everything in my professional training, everything in my personal experience tells me this is what is needed.
How can you enable somebody to go with that?
Yes.
Instinct.
And we have to trust, I think, more, the autonomy of the clinician.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
We've moved too far. Of course, there were abuses which had to be stopped.
Yes.
And still had to be stopped. But take away the autonomy of the clinician and you've just got another set of abuses.
Thank you very much, Tim, for being with us this afternoon, for taking the time to share your thoughts with us. And we're very pleased that you'll be with us live on air for a webinar on the 8th of December between 6 o'clock and 7. When you, the audience, will be able to talk to us and share your thoughts and ask questions. Until then, goodbye.